From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's hard to imagine Neil Gaiman not becoming a writer. His life has always been defined by books. He was an early reader. At age 4, he began to read everything he could get his hands on. And these days, he's immensely popular for his comic books and fantasy novels and horror and science fiction. So it's too late to go back now, but just hypothetically, if he couldn't write, Gaiman says he knows what he would do. He would design religions for people. It's a little tongue-in-cheek, but it's a job, he says, that requires the same gifts he's used during his career so far. Today in the program, we're broadcasting a conversation with Neil Gaiman, recorded over the weekend in Park City, about stories and gods and books and beehives, the kind of conversation you'd expect with Neil Gaiman, after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The writer Neil Gaiman's latest story collection was released last fall. It contained the kinds of stories you'd expect. Horror and fantasy, something for kids, something for the grown-ups. Gaiman has built up a sizable, near cult-like fan base over the years, not to mention a massive Twitter following. And everyone seems to have their Gaiman entry point. Some first came to him with his comic book series, The Sandman. Others fell in love with Coraline, the horror novella for children. And then there are the novels like Neverwhere, American Gods, The Ocean at the End of the Lane. Gaiman was in Utah over the weekend at the Eccles Center in Park City. That's where we recorded our conversation, which today in the program we're going to broadcast. We began with that new story collection, which Gaiman titled Trigger Warning. It's a term you sometimes see on the internet. It's a warning that an article or an image may be upsetting, may trigger anxiety or flashbacks or fear. And Gaiman isn't so sure he likes trigger warnings, at least not for stories and books. He doesn't think, for example, people should be taught Romeo and Juliet with a warning that it contains murder and suicide, even though, of course, it does. Gaiman says it's good to come to a story relatively unprepared.
And it was this wonderful, fascinating thing for me, because I started thinking, well, what kinds of warnings do you give? When I did Sandman, it was a comic, and it contained the phrase, for mature readers, on the cover, and we never defined mature readers, very intentionally. I mean, it wasn't really going to hold up in court. But it meant that a comic store could look at somebody and go, we're not going to sell you this. And it also meant that if somebody went, I read Sandman and have been deeply troubled by it, we can go, well, it said for mature readers.
I want to have you read a section because you say that we all need to find out what fiction is for us because it's an experience that's going to be unlike anyone else's experience. So read this section, if you would, from the introduction.
What we read as adults should be read, I think, with no warnings or alerts beyond, perhaps, enter at your own risk. We need to find out what fiction is, what it means to us, an experience that is going to be unlike anyone else's experience of the story. We build the stories in our heads. We take words and we give them power. And we look out through other eyes and we see and experience what others see. I wonder, are fictions safe places? And then I ask myself, should they be safe places? There are stories I read as a child I wished once I'd read them that I'd never encountered because I was not ready for them, and they upset me. Stories which contained helplessness, in which people were embarrassed or mutilated, in which adults were made vulnerable and parents could be of no assistance. They troubled me and haunted my nightmares and my daydreams, worried and upset me on profound levels. But they also taught me that if I was going to read fiction, Sometimes I would only know what my comfort zone was by leaving it. And now, as an adult, I would not erase the experience of having read them if I could. There are still things that profoundly upset me when I encounter them, whether it's on the web or the word or in the world. They never get easier, never stop my heart from trip-trapping, never let me escape, this time unscathed. But they teach me things, and they open my eyes, and if they hurt, they hurt in ways that make me think and grow and change.
You published the book Coraline in 2002. And during the process of getting it published, there was this question about whether or not it was too frightening for children.
It wasn't even whether it was too frightening for children. It was simply what kind of a book it was.
Right.
And you have to bear in mind that I'd started writing Coraline in about 1991, 1992. I'd written the first third of it. I'd given it to my editor at the time, a wonderful man called Richard Evans, and at Golanx Books, who published Good Omens. And Richard said, Neil, it's really good. It may be the best thing you've written so far, but it is unpublishable. And I said, why? And he said, well, you've written a book that is apparently both intended for children and adults, and you can't publish that. And you've written what appears to be a horror novel for children, and you can't publish that. And I went, fair enough, and sort of put it aside. And then the years went by. It was about 1998, and then maybe 99. And I suddenly realized that my youngest daughter, Maddie, was 5. And I started writing Coraline for Holly, her older sister, who was now about 14. And I thought, I have to finish this book. And I sent it off to my agent, Merrily. And Merrily read it and called me and said, what do you think I'm going to do with this? And I said, well, I think it's a children's book, and I think you should send it to the children's division of HarperCollins. And she was like, well, I think it's too scary for children. I said, I don't. I read it to Maddie. She survived. So I think, I'll tell you what, you have 2 daughters. You have Morgan, aged about 6, and you have Emily, aged about 8. Read it to them. And if they're happy with it, we'll send it to Harper Children's. And obviously, if not, I will pay for therapy. So. So I got a phone call about a week later from Merrily saying Morgan and Emily loved it. They thought it was wonderful. They didn't think it was scary at all. I'm sending it down to Harper Children's. And she sent it to Harper Children's. They loved it. They published it. It came out. About 8 years later, I was at the it's the Lorraine Lortel Theatre in New York at the film of Coraline had already come out. This was a musical with music by Stephen Merritt. And I was sitting next to Morgan, Merrily's daughter, who at this point, 15, 16. And I said, you know, this all happened because of you, because you weren't scared. And she said, how do you mean? I said, well, when your mum read it to you, do you remember when you were a little kid? You weren't scared, so this happened. She said, I was terrified. She said, but I knew if I showed fear, I wouldn't find out how it ended. So Coraline exists in the world because Morgan DeFiore lied.
Your parents, some of you may know this story, it's a great story. Your parents actually built you a shed on the property where you lived. And this is a place where you would go to retreat, to read. And I can't tell if it was just that you wanted peace and quiet, or if it was also an act of, you know, emancipation or independence.
It was, as far as I'm concerned, it was still the very best birthday present I ever had. And I don't know, looking back on it now, quite how I got the idea of asking for it. But I was about 9 years old, and my parents said, "What do you want for your birthday?" And I said, "I want a shed." They were like, "What?" I said, "I want a shed where I can go and read, where nobody else can come and bother me." And that was what it was. It was my shed. And I would go down there, I'd take an apple and a book, and I'd be in my shed.
In the introduction to Trigger Warnings, you write that you were once a blank piece of parchment waiting to be inscribed. And I heard you talk about the influence of C.S. Lewis, for example, as the first writer to make you aware, this is how you put it, the first writer to make you aware somebody was writing the book that you were reading. Explain that.
I loved books.
But what did you think before that?
Before that, I knew that books were getting written.
Yeah.
I knew that there were authors, and I knew that authors were different. All of that stuff I had intellectually. C.S. Lewis, who I discovered when I was six, did something very different, because he would address the reader directly. And sometimes he'd just do it in parentheses. He'd put these brackets, and he'd say something like, "And this was, you know, this was not the kind of thing that you have in your day. This was in a long time ago when they did things like this," or whatever. And I felt suddenly like there was actually a person writing these books, and made that leap. They weren't being produced by some kind of writing machine. They didn't exist in the same way that stones or rocks or trees existed. Somebody was making this up and telling you what happened. And in C.S. Lewis's case, doing it so very confidently that it seemed much more interesting than the real world, which I appreciated enormously.
When did it occur to you that you then yourself could do the creation? You yourself could do the writing? Did that come later?
The funny thing is, I don't know that I actually was ever serious about thinking about writing on the one hand until I was 20, 21. Wow. But on the other hand, all of my fantasies as a 9-year-old, as a 10-year-old, as an 11-year-old, the kind of fantasies where kids ought to be fantasizing about being an astronaut or something. I was putting together these complex fantasy sort of daydreams in which I got to be the person who wrote The Lord of the Rings, which I would do by having a copy of Lord of the Rings with me and then accidentally slipping into a parallel universe which was exactly the same, except Tolkien had never existed and had not written Lord of the Rings.
Right.
And then I would obviously have to get the manuscript, get the book typed up to send to a publisher, because I couldn't just send this thing to a publisher because they'd know. They would be suspicious. I would have to find an adult, because I was like 11 and I couldn't type. So I would find an adult. They would have to type, you know, 1,000 pages of Lord of the Rings. Then I'd have to murder them. They couldn't be allowed to live. They knew too much. And then the book would go off to a publisher, and I would be the person who wrote Lord of the Rings. So what I love looking back on it now about those kind of fantasies, there was another great fantasy in which I kidnapped every writer I liked from across space and time and made them collaborate on a giant novel. And what I love about those things is they're all sort of writery fantasies. In none of them do I actually sit down and do the work.
Right.
But they were but there was definitely this kind of thing in which I didn't sit around going, I want to be a writer. That it had never occurred to me that I could be a writer. I thought, I'm going to have to be an English teacher or an actor or a lawyer or some real job that involves getting up in the morning and going to work, because being a writer seems so unlikely. And it wasn't until I was 21, maybe, I had this incredibly bad night. And it was, I think, the first time I'd ever had a completely sleepless night. I just lay there and my mind churned and I kept thinking, you know, I think in my secret heart, I'm a writer. And the problem with this is that I'm not doing anything about it. And the problem with that is if I go through my entire life and don't do anything about it, one day I'll be 80 or 90, I'll be in hospital, I'll be heading towards death, and what I will be thinking is, I could have been a writer. And the thing that will hurt is I won't know if I'm lying to myself or not.
Neil Gaiman. He was in town over the weekend, a guest of the Park City Institute. We recorded the conversation at the Eccles Center in Park City. Gaiman also took questions from the audience that night. We didn't have time to include them in the program today, but you can hear them on our website, KUER.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we're broadcasting a conversation with the writer Neil Gaiman. Gaiman is an immensely popular writer of fantasy and horror, science fiction, short stories, as you'll hear later, even poetry. He was in Park City over the weekend, and he joined us on the stage at the Eccles Center in Park City to talk about his affection for reading and stories and other things. There's a moment in his popular comic book series, The Sandman, where the main character, Morpheus, puts a curse on someone. It's an affliction of this endless stream of ideas. And I asked Gaiman if he ever felt that way.
I go backwards and forwards on where I would like to be at my death. When I die, do I want to die with 5 books unwritten and 6 or 7 great ideas for short stories and a poem that I should write? Or do I want to have finished and just be sitting around? And I think, well, actually, I'd really like to die with some good ideas still not quite done yet. When I was talking to some of the kids who are here tonight backstage, a question a few of them asked me was, where do you get your ideas? Because kids are the only people who are brave enough to ask writers where we get our ideas. Adults know that you risk being mocked. But the truth is, actually, the only question that is worth asking is, where do you get your ideas? And the best reply I can give is, well, everybody has ideas. You have ideas all the time. That's what you do when you wind up staring out the window. You call it daydreaming. For a writer, it's just getting an idea, and sometimes it's just following a train of thought around, and you ask yourself questions like, what if? And if only? And if this goes on? And what would happen then?
You say in the introduction of Trigger Warning something really interesting. You say when you put a story collection together, Trigger Warnings, I think, is your third, you say you start to see themes that reoccur. And you say, I learn what I've been writing about for the last decade. So what have you been writing about for the last decade? What are the themes that you think you've detected so far?
Well, it is fascinating because essentially I've wound up being a professional writer now for 30 years. And I have 3 short story collections, so one for each decade. Trigger warning, the stories in there mostly seem to have something to do with identity and a lot to do with memory. Memory, thematically, I think, spreads all the way through what we do to be remembered, what we do to be forgotten, how we remember. There's a short story in there that I wrote for Ray Bradbury's 91st birthday as a birthday present for Ray, called The Man Who Forgot Ray Bradbury. Which is, it's probably in some ways one of the saddest things I've ever written.
It's so lovely. And there's a moment in it where you invoke a prayer.
That came from a story I heard when I was 12. Just an old Jewish folk tale about a man who is lost in the woods without his prayer book. He's lost his prayer book. And he realizes he doesn't actually know any prayers by heart. And so he looks up and he says, God, I don't have my prayer book on me. I don't actually know any prayers by heart. But you're God. And you know all the prayers. So I'm going to say the alphabet and you can put them together in the correct order. And I just loved that.
That's great.
But I did love as well using that story to break your heart with. At the end, it's always nice to take something that's kind of funny and then turn it a little bit. And that story began with me. It began with a couple of things happening at the same time, one of which was Terry Pratchett had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And he's one of my oldest friends. We've been friends for 30 years. And he was 57, 58 years old. And he had the Alzheimer's diagnosis. And that was shocking and hurtful. And the other thing was, I forgot the name of a friend. He was a guy who died 10 years before. We'd been friends. We'd spoken once a month. He'd written an introduction to one of my books. And one day I went looking in my head for his name, and it wasn't there. And I thought, I could Google, and then I will go, oh, you idiot, of course. But I thought, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to, it'll come back. It's just that thing that you get when you get old, where when you're young, it's like when you need to remember things. You have somebody on skates who goes, zoom, runs down to the files, and zoom, they're back, and there's the thing. And when you get older, sometimes you think, okay, and I need to know the name of that town in Georgia. And somewhere there's somebody going, now don't you get too worried about that young man. I'll be back with it soon. And and you can see him getting up and dusting himself off and heading off. And 5 minutes later you go, you know, there's that town in Georgia. I still can't remember what it was called. And nope, going down the steps now. And then finally you go, I've completely given up on that town in Georgia. And you start talking to somebody about something else, and you're 3/4 of the way through this conversation, and suddenly you go, Savannah. And they say, what? And you go, nothing. So he finally gets back, holding his piece of paper.
Your good friend Alan Moore, the great comic book writer, said that your best work comes from characters or situations in the real world starkly juxtaposed with this misty fantasy world. And then I read this from Laurie Penny of The New Statesman. She had interviewed you. She said, under the ordinary, there is a dark other world, and ordinary people make their way there. And the thing that both of those have in common are ordinary characters and then fantasy worlds, the mixture of those. Did they get that right?
Probably, although I you know, you work so very hard over the years to not repeat yourself. Mm. And you get up and you fail to write all of the sequels that you really ought to have written. But instead, you do something completely new and weird and shiny. And you go, ha-ha, I'm going to write, okay, I just did Stardust, and that's a book that's kind of like a traditional fairy tale in Victorian England. So the next thing I will do will be American Gods, and it will be big and thick and contemporary, and it will have lots of swearing and sex and death and nothing like that last thing. And here's a children's book now about a girl whose parents don't quite pay her enough attention, but there's another world where these other mother and other father pay her lots of attention, but they want to replace her eyes with big black buttons. And now I've done that, I will write a funny novel about, you know, and you go, ha ha, look at me. I am unpindownable. And then, you know, Laurie Penny does it in a sentence. And you go,
right.
Thank you, Laurie Penny.
Did you really say that if you had not been a writer, you would have wanted to design religions?
I did. This is... a lot of this has to do with the fact that, as I was explaining to somebody earlier today, you really do not want me driving your taxi. I will get distracted and start thinking about stories, and either you won't get where you were meaning to go, or you won't go the route that you were meant to go, or something unlikely will happen. And you don't want me putting up your shelves. Your things will roll off and break, and then the shelf will fall down. There are things I'm good at, mostly to do with making things up, and there are things I'm not good at, mostly to do with, you know, anything else. So I was trying to think what I would like to, what my dream job would be if I couldn't be a writer. And I thought, what I'd really like to do is design, be a sort of freelance religion designer for people. And they'd phone you up. And you'd say, okay, so what kind of religion would you like? How many of you want to be part? Okay, so this is a very small religion. There'll be 11 of you, okay. Do you want a holy day? Where do you stand on sin? And do you want a pantheon or any kind? Okay, so you don't want a god. Okay, you want devils? Good, we can do that. I would do that. I would love to do that. Unfortunately, the nearest you get to do that is sitting down in books.
There's this great story I've heard you tell about when you were going to be bar mitzvahed, that you managed to distract your bar mitzvah instructor by getting him to tell you stories.
This is true.
What was that about? What were the stories that you were trying to get from that?
It was so good. That was the Reverend Meyer Lev, a wonderful, incredibly orthodox cantor. My parents, who weren't terribly Jewish, but had decided that I needed to be at least for the 6 months around my bar mitzvah, had started sending me up for about 18 months before my bar mitzvah to my relatives in North London, in Harrow. And I would go up and stay with them, and Rev Lev would come over, and I would never have actually done the thing that I was meant to have done, and I wouldn't have studied the stuff I was meant to have studied, and my Hebrew was appalling and remains appalling. I mean, it's practically non-existent now, and it was terrible then. But what I loved about him was, and I didn't know it at the time, was he was a fountain of obscure Jewish folk tales, stories, biblical explanations, Midrash, Talmud, all of this stuff. And he also existed in a peculiar universe in which nothing was metaphorical.
Wow.
Everything was completely literal. And this was how God did it. And occasionally I would be baffled because I would hear him explain something as a true thing that had happened. And I'd read it as a joke in Leo Rosten's The Joys of Yiddish. And I knew it was a gag. But what was wonderful was I could get him off the subject onto these amazing stories. And it wasn't until I was in my mid-20s that I discovered that not everybody knew all of these glorious stories. Things like Adam's Three Wives, which I put into Sandman, only after I discovered that people didn't know it. You know, lots of people had heard of Lilith, Adam's first wife, and lots of people knew about Eve. But then there was wife number two, after Lilith left to go and consort with demons, as wives sometimes do. Which was apparently entirely his fault.
Right.
Because, anyway.
But here's the thing that...
suddenly realized I'm not going to go there. But wife number two got created in front of Adam. God, you know, started with a skeleton and then put nerves on it and muscles and flesh and pumped blood through and then put skin and hair, and Adam wouldn't go near her. Which is why God had to put him to sleep to create Eve. And I just loved stories like that.
I think what interests me about the fact that you are taking in these stories that young, when you were supposed to be studying religion, basically, this is something you've said. You said, because I'm good at making things up, I look at everything else people have made up and say, you know, people made that up. Is that how you see religion? Not to say that people are just making this up, but how do you see religion and myth as stories that we make up?
I think they are true and they are beautiful in exactly the same way that national boundaries are true and beautiful. You know, the minds of people are wonderful, wonderful things. And also, I think you very much get to... one of the things that's always fascinated me and delighted me is that people very often get to live in the universe they want to live in.
Yeah.
They live in the world they want to live in. There is a tremendous subjectivity to truth, because at the point where you see the world in one way, that's the place... It's like religion becomes a place to stand in order to see the world and to make sense of it and to judge how you're going to behave and to decide what you're going to do. But I think the glorious thing about all of these things is there is so much that we do not stop and think about. One of the reasons why I love comparing them to national boundaries is they don't really exist either. But we all act as if they do. And so they do. That's kind of how I tend to view all of these things. They're things that we use to get along. And I don't know that any of them are very true if you get out to about Saturn and look down here with a giant telescope. But without that, you know, things like money, they work for us. We use them.
You write in the introduction of Trigger Warning, I'm not scared of bad people, of wicked evildoers and monsters. The people who scare me are the ones who are certain of their own rightness.
This remains true. And And I think it's the worst thing about people. And it's the thing that, you know, you get to, when you look back through history, and when you wind up dealing with people who are in every way awful, as sometimes you do, you're going, according to the rules of fiction, you're meant to be standing there going, ha ha ha, you think that's bad, watch what I will do to you next. And in actual fact, the people who are doing the most monstrous things are going, well, it's for their own good. These people are just going to have to learn. And, you know, we are protecting them. And you're going, well, I know you're not protecting them. And, but it does get to that sort of monstrous, it can get to absolutely monstrous levels. And I wish that I thought that the people, you know, the ISIS people who are beheading innocents, innocence is a ridiculous word, who are beheading people, I wish they thought they were the bad guys. They don't. They're certain that they're the good guys because they're doing the right thing and they're proud of it. You know, for that matter, I wish the guys who'd flown the planes, the 9/11 planes into the World Trade Center, had been going, ha-ha, we are the bad guys. They didn't. The thing that makes it monstrous, the thing that makes it sad, is they were absolutely certain they were doing the right thing.
What do you love about beekeeping?
And that answer when we get back from a break. We recorded our conversation with Neil Gaiman at the Eccles Center for the Performing Arts in Park City. He was a guest of the Park City Institute. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the writer Neil Gaiman, recorded in Park City on Saturday night. When we left off, I had asked him what he loved about keeping bees.
I discovered the concept of beekeeping by reading the Sherlock Holmes books as a kid. Then I discovered colony collapse disorder, heard about that the bees were vanishing, and I thought, this is my chance. I can be a beekeeper. There will be more bees around just because I'm doing this. But then once I started doing it, I realized the real reason that I loved beekeeping. Apart from just the bees and the fascination and the fact that I can get so dull on the subject of beekeeping. I can bore you with the minute eye of hive design in the 1860s. I can do this. But the thing that I really decided was actually everybody should have a hobby that could kill them.
There is such a great story in Trigger Warning called The Case of Death and Honey. This is a Sherlock Holmes story. I want you to say a little bit about this. So you were, as I understand it, you understood, reading the Sherlock Holmes stories, that he, in his dotage, kept bees. But that didn't make sense to you.
It didn't. It was an important part of the Sherlock Holmes canon, that he retires to the South Downs to keep bees. And I lived very near the South Downs. They're beautiful. Very, very peaceful. Which seemed very peculiar because Sherlock Holmes several times during the canon talks about how dodgy things are out in the country and how, you know, the city is safe and sane, but out there in the country, anything could be happening in those little houses. And so that fascinated me. And I thought the other thing that we are told over and over again is he goes mad if he is not on a case. He gets bored if he's not on a case. He winds up, you know, addicted to various drugs through the thing because he doesn't have a case and he just needs to occupy his mind. I thought, well, why would he have retired to keep bees? And now I was a beekeeper. And the thing that I discovered about beekeeping that you discover very quickly when you start beekeeping is it's not a lot of work. Mostly the bees are doing all the work. There are several days during the year where you have to work very hard. You may have to introduce bees to a hive. You may have to requeen here or put more more boxes, more levels on the top. They're called supers, and you put them on to raise the thing up so the bees... There's stuff you're going to do, but mostly what you're going to do is absolutely nothing. And I thought, my vision of Sherlock Holmes getting up in the morning and industriously beekeeping from morning till night, that didn't happen. He must have been on a case. And that was one of those what ifs. Why? And I started thinking about that. And
don't give it away.
I won't.
Because there's such a grand secret in there. It's a great story. Why? I know that you came to the United States out of circumstance, but why did you stay?
You know, the weird thing is when I moved to America, and it was moving to America at the time, it was a weird combination of the fact that all of my work back then was for American companies. I was being paid in dollars under the economic leadership of the George Bush before last. They weren't worth anything. I liked the idea of coming to a country where they would be worth something. You know. But my plan at the time was to come out for about 3 years. Moved out in 92, thought, yes, in 3 years, I'll move back to the UK. But then the kids were doing really well at school. Life was kind of fun and quiet. There was a new baby. And after a while, I was looking around going, well, I'll move back to the UK when Maddie, my youngest, turns 18. When she graduates from high school, I'll be like a rat up a drainpipe. I'll be gone. And I was counting down the days. I bought a little house on the Isle of Skye in Western Scotland. It was great. Scottish property websites became my pornography. I'd look at them late at night when there was nobody else around. I like you, click. I like you, click. And I was really, really looking forward to going back to the UK. And then, the beginning of 2008, I met Amanda Palmer. And Maddie at that point was 14-ish. So I was still waiting for her to graduate. And a couple of years later, I looked up and realized that I was married to an American who had no intention of ever going to Scotland, except maybe in August for the Edinburgh Festival, and even then she would complain about how chilly it was. So that's basically why I stayed. I stayed initially, and also it fascinated me. There was a period through the 90s in particular where I slowly realized that although I'd written a lot of stories set in America, when younger, and was writing Sandman and stuff set in America. And people would say to me, well, how can you write America? You're English. And I would say, yes, but I've been watching your TV and your movies since I was a child. I may not be able to write a Seattle that feels as much like Seattle as somebody who lives in Seattle would write, but I'm probably writing the same Seattle that somebody who lives in New York would write. You know, so... But then moving out here and going, this place is so much weirder than I had ever imagined. And it's weirder in really interesting ways that nobody told me about. And that began to fascinate me. I became absolutely obsessed for several years with American roadside attractions. Because there's nothing like them in England. And I would go to them and I would say, explain this to me. And people would say, how do you mean? And I'm saying, I am standing in front of a replica of the largest cheese created for the 1964 World's Fair. It's not even a real cheese. It is a replica cheese. Why? And because they could not answer, I wrote American Gods. That was...
American Gods is about immigrants who bring their own gods with them, but then they abandon them as they take on their life here. Did you abandon your gods when you took on your life here?
I have this theory that as long as I keep my English citizenship, drink tea, and sometimes spread Marmite on things, despite my wife's revulsion.
But as long as you have the Marmite and the tea and the citizenship, you retain the gods.
I retain the English gods, yes. Although in my case, that was actually, for me, the fun of writing the last story in this book, Black Dog. It was just some of the stuff that I love about wandering around England, the feeling that you are moving through layers of time. It has often occurred to me that England and Britain, we have history, and here in America, you have geography. The English are baffled that America is a place in which 100 years is a long time. The Americans are baffled that in England, 100 miles is a long way. But in England, everything feels very layered. I mean, a lot of the Graveyard book, for me, was actually about the idea that you can have time going back. You know, you can have an old graveyard, and the oldest graves could be 2,000 years old or more. And I loved that.
Say something about this poem, would you, and read it?
Of course. So this is the poem that opens Trigger Warning. I cheerfully inflict about 5 or 6 poems on the readers, which I also point out in the introduction come free. You are not paying for the poems. The book would cost you the same without the poems. I've thrown them in free. And this was a poem, really, I guess, about being a writer. And being a writer is a very odd thing, because sometimes being a writer is about writing and actually sitting there and, as somebody once said, staring at a page, a blank page, until your forehead bleeds. But sometimes it's about the other stuff that happens, and sometimes it's about not writing. It's called Making a Chair. Today, I intended to begin to write. Stories are waiting like distant thunderstorms, grumbling and flickering on the gray horizon. And there are emails and introductions and a book, a whole damn book about a country and a journey and belief I'm here to write. I made a chair. I opened a cardboard box with a blade. I assembled the blade, removed the parts, carried them carefully up the stairs. Functional seating for today's workplace. I pressed 5 casters into the base, learned that they press in with the most satisfying pop. attached the armrests with the screws puzzling over the left and the right of it, the screws not being what they should be, as described in the instructions, and then the base beneath the seat, which attached with six 40 millimeter screws that were puzzlingly six 45 millimeter screws. Then the headpiece to the chair back to the seat, which is where the problems start, as the middle screw on either side declines to penetrate and thread. This all takes time. Orson Welles is Harry Lime on the old radio as I assemble my chair. Orson meets a dame and a crooked fortune teller and a fat man and a New York gang boss in exile and has slept with the dame, solved the mystery, read the script and pocketed the money before I have assembled my chair. Making a book is a little like making a chair. Perhaps it ought to come with warnings, like the chair instructions, a folded piece of paper slipped into each copy, warning us only for one person at a time. Do not use as a stool or stepladder. Failure to follow these warnings can result in serious injury. One day, I will write another book. And when I'm done, I will climb it like a stool or a stepladder or a high old wooden ladder propped against the side of a plum tree in the autumn. And I will be gone. But for now, I shall follow these warnings and finish making the chair.
Neil Gaiman. He was in town over the weekend, a guest of the Park City Institute. Gaiman took questions from the audience that night. You can hear them and his reading from a section of the book Good Omens by going to our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. The program was recorded by our engineer, Lewis Downey. Our thanks to Terry Orr and Jenny Canock of the Park City Institute, who invited us to be part of the evening. Thanks also to Jim Craig and the rest of the staff at the Eccles Center for the Performing Arts. Radio West is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.